Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he deplored the terrorist attack in Somalia and also continued his reflections on Christian hope and spoke about the reality of death. Insights into a modern-day spiritual hero. We look back at the figure of Pope St. John Paul II on his liturgical feast day, with the help of his biographer George Weigel and the Vatican expert John Allen. John Paul's prayer life, as told by one of his closest advisers, the late Cardinal Roberto Tucci, who was the chief organiser of the Pope's pastoral visits abroad, speaks about John Paul's intense prayer life and how the papacy's temporal power finished. A leading church historian takes us back to the year 1870, when Italian unification forces charged into Rome and put an end to the Papal States. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience on October the 18th, where he deplored the terrorist attack on the Somali capital Mogadishu that killed over 300 people. Earlier, in his catechesis, he continued his reflections on Christian hope and spoke about the reality of death. Linda Bordoni reports.
This terrorist act, Pope Francis said, deserves to be most strongly deplored, also because it falls on a population that is already suffering deeply.
Questo atto terroristico merita la più ferma deplorazione.
I implore the conversion of those who are violent, he said, and send my encouragement to those who, with enormous difficulties, are working for peace in that tortured land.
Imploro la conversione dei violenti.
And during his catechesis, the Pope reminded Christians that Jesus came to heal us and to save us from death, noting that death is a reality that modern civilization tends more and more to set aside and not to reflect upon. Pope Francis said that for believers, death is actually a door, a call to live for something greater.
Quando la morte arriva, perché ci sta vicino per noi stessi, ci troviamo impreparati.
The Pope invited those present to think of the moment of their death and imagine the time when Jesus will take us by hand and say, "Come, rise and come with me," saying that in that moment hope will end and it will become reality. He encouraged the faithful to be prepared for death, pointing out that our days, no matter how many they are, pass like a breath. Death, he said, lays bare our lives, forcing us to acknowledge that all those actions born from pride, anger and hatred were useless and vain, while all the good things we have done will support us and hold us by the hand. Ultimately, the Pope explained, Jesus is the one who helps us to confront the mystery of death. He shows us that it is natural to weep and to mourn the loss of a loved one, just as he wept at the death of Lazarus. But Jesus reminds us never to be afraid, but to keep the flame of faith burning.
Non avere paura. Continua solo a tenere accesa quella fiamma.
We are small and defenseless, Pope Francis concluded, before the mystery of death. But if we keep faith alive, Jesus will take us by the hand and he will say, I say to you, arise. I'm Linda Bordoni.
October the 22nd is the liturgical feast day of Saint John Paul II, a modern-day spiritual hero, who was Pope from 1978 to 2005. He was canonised together with Pope John the 23rd on the 27th of April 2014, which was Divine Mercy Sunday. We revisit the figure of this much-loved Polish-born saint.
Non abbiate paura, aprite anzi spalancate le porte a Cristo.
Do not be afraid. Open wide the doors to Christ. It was these ringing and much quoted words pronounced by Pope John Paul II at his inaugural Mass on October the 22nd, 1978, that set the tone for his long papacy. This was a pope who was not afraid to take the gospel message to the far corners of the earth during his frequent travels, and who wanted all Christians to have the courage to let Christ into their lives. The first pope from Poland, Karol Wojtyła, was a man whose life and achievements made him a towering figure on the world stage. And just 9 years after his death, he was raised to sainthood.
Ioannem Paulum II, Sanctus esse decernimus et definimus, ac sanctorum catalogo ascribimus.
But what was Pope John Paul II like as a person, as a man? One American who became a personal friend of the late Pope was George Weigel, Catholic scholar and author of two biographies on John Paul II. Weigel met the Polish Pope dozens of times before and during the research for his books, and shares with us his insights into the character of Karol Wojtyła, the man.
Dear young friends, I pray that your faith in Christ will always be lively and strong. This way, you will always be ready to tell others the reason for your hope. You will be messenger of hope.
In terms of qualities or characteristics, I would say he was the most relentlessly curious man I have ever met. He was always wanting to know what was going on. What were the books? What were the movies? What were the arguments? What were the articles? What was going on in the worlds that I touched that he couldn't touch directly? In other words, this was a man who was constantly looking ahead. There was nothing nostalgic about his personality at all. And I came to understand that curiosity not so much as a psychological tick of some sort, but as a reflection of his deep Christian faith. He really believed that Providence was at work in history, and therefore he wanted to know what was going on, because that allowed him insights into how the divine will was working itself out in perhaps surprising ways at this moment in time.
And did he ever laugh or joke with you? And if so, what about?
Oh, yes. He had a very robust sense of humor that tended towards the ironic, but it was not irony in the kind of cynical sense of irony. It was irony in the sense of, oh, wow, look at what the Holy Spirit has done now in a surprising way. He once, as I report in the book, The End and the Beginning, invited a Polish actor who was in Rome to town. And in the course of the conversation, he asked him what role this man was playing in a very famous Polish play called Forefather's Eve. And the actor, a man named Jerzy Stor, said, "Your Holiness, I regret to report that I am Satan," who is a character in the play. And the Pope thought about this a minute and said, "Well, none of us gets to choose our roles, do we?"
Good one. Yes. How Polish was he in his outlook, his friends, his habits?
I think he was a great Polish patriot who understood that much of his personal formation, intellectual formation, came out of the richness of 1,000 years of Polish culture and history. I would say the most strikingly Polish thing about him, though, was not what he ate on holidays, or that Polish sisters cooked for him, or that he loved to sing Polish Christmas carols to the 15th verse with his old friends over the telephone back to Poland. It was his way of looking at history. Poland, the state, disappeared from the map of Europe for 123 years. Poland, the nation, survived that through its culture. And that taught him that the most dynamic force in human affairs over the long haul is not politics, it's not economics, it's culture. And that gave him the capacity to bend history in a different way by revitalizing cultures, for at the heart of culture is religion, what we cherish, honor, and worship. And that, I think, was his theory of historical change.
Young men and women, you are the future of the world, and the day of tomorrow belongs to you.
John Allen is the editor of Crux and is one of the world's leading commentators on Vatican and Catholic affairs. He too shared with me his memories of Pope John Paul II.
Well, I think John Paul II was one of those almost once-in-a-generation guys who had this kind of animal charisma that just dominated any room he was ever in. Wicked sense of humor, absolutely fearless, willing to say anything to anyone at any time, marvelous command of gestures in facial expressions and so forth. I mean, he could communicate more with a withering look or a smile than most of us can in, 1,800-word news analyses. The first time I had an opportunity to meet him in person was on a papal trip in 2001. We were going to Kazakhstan, and this was 9 days after 9/11. So there's a lot of media interest in that trip and what John Paul would have to say. So it had been a very exhausting trip. At the end of it, those of us who were new had the opportunity to come down and sit next to the Pope in Shepherd One, the papal plane, and have a few moments with him. Now, by that stage in my career, you have to understand that I had probably written several million words about the Pope. I had talked about him for hours on television. I mean, in theory, if someone was going to be capable of coming up with something intelligent to say to him in that moment, you would think it would be me. And yet when I was plunked down in that chair next to him, the sort of awesomeness of the moment sort of overcame me. And the only thing, honest to God, the only thing I could croak out was, "Holy Father, it's nice to meet you." I mean, the most banal thing imaginable. And he could tell that I was struggling to come up with something more intelligent to say. And he reached out to me and patted me on the arm and said, "It's okay." And then went on to give me a couple of thoughts about what the trip had meant that I didn't even ask. But had I been able to formulate intelligent questions, these would have been great answers. I mean, in other words, he understood. I mean, he'd been in those situations often enough to know that, even people who aren't supposed to be intimidated by him nevertheless were. And he broke that ice on his own. It was a marvelous, not only was it a great sort of communication strategy on his part, it was a marvelous pastoral act.
I was speaking there to John Allen, editor of Crux, that specializes in coverage of the Vatican and the Catholic Church. And earlier, you heard the voice of George Weigel, biographer and friend of Saint John Paul II.
Hey, John Paul, we can finish the race for you. Hey, John Paul, we can carry the flame within. How to love the mother, taught us how to love the son. You taught us how to carry the flame and run to the ends of the earth. Staying
on the subject of St. John Paul II, we bring you now a programme that looks at the Polish Pope's intense prayer life, as recounted by one of his closest advisers. He was the late Jesuit Cardinal Roberto Tucci, who was the chief organiser of almost all John Paul's journeys abroad during his papacy. He was interviewed by Veronica Scaresbrick.
Capacity of the Holy Father to isolate himself from whatever is happening around him and concentrate in prayer. And for a long time, not only, when we were visiting a church, he would stay 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, the altar where the Blessed Sacrament was kept, and I was anxious about the program, because perhaps we were already late, but also in his own chapel. And even during the Pope's visit to different countries in the morning, in the Nunciature, generally we were living in the Nunciature of the Holy Father, he would stay minimum 3/4 of an hour alone in the chapel, very first in the morning. Being in the same situation, I would have been able also to pray a little bit, but I would be more interested in the rehearsal of the speeches here to give during the day. You know that when I visited Poland, Krakow, I discovered, for me it was a discovery, but anyway, that the Holy Father, when he was Archbishop there, he would write his own personal important documents kneeling in his chapel, where they had prepared for him a special kneeling,
Prie-Dieu.
Which was where he was able even to write. And there was a lamp, so he could, even in the night or in the evening, he could work kneeling or seated, but in front of the Blessed Sacrament.
And many thanks there to Veronica Scarsbrick for that interview with the late Cardinal Roberto Tucci. Now turn back the pages of our history book on the Vatican to 1870, a year that marked the end of the papacy's temporal power after many centuries. It was on September the 20th, 1870, that Italian unification troops captured Rome after breaching the city's walls by the Porta Pia gate, and the Pope of the time, Pius IX, retreated across the River Tiber to the Vatican. The capture of Rome completed the final step in the unification of Italy. Find out more about this turbulent period in papal history by listening to this special programme prepared by Veronica Scarsbrick.
Ever heard of the breach of Porta Pia when on September the 20th, 1870, the 12th Battalion of the Bersaglieri charged into Rome, opening with their cannons an entrance into the old Aurelian walls of Rome, a dozen metres west of the Michelangelesque gate, which stands there to this day. A gate located in a straight line with the Quirinal Palace, which had been, until that day, the residence of the Roman Pontiff to head the Papal States. Papal States that after that breach no longer existed, as the unity of Italy with this military operation completed the process of political unification. From that day on, the Pope of the time, Pius IX, retreated to the Vatican, and the Quirinal Palace became the residence first of the kings of Italy, and then, as from 1946, of the presidents of the Republic of Italy. That's what I knew, but what I wondered about was whether Pius IX had retreated across the Tiber of his own will. So I put that question to church historian, Jesuit, Professor Gerald Fogarty.
By and large it was. The Italian Parliament in 1872 passed the Law of Guarantees, giving him certain monetary contribution for the loss of his temporal power. It wasn't that much, really. Nevertheless, he, in protest, moved into the Vatican and became the self-imposed prisoner of the Vatican.
Of course, the Vatican City-State, as we know it today, didn't exist at the time. That only came into being with the so-called Lateran Pacts in 1929. Curiously, the United States, though, had relations with the Vatican long before it came into being as a state.
The United States did have diplomatic relations with the Papal States, which were broken off in 1867. Actually, they weren't broken off. The United States Congress refused funding for it, but it was part of what we call Reconstruction after the American Civil War, where this radical group took over Congress after the assassination of Lincoln. So technically speaking, diplomatic relations continued. We might come back to that because in 1983, that was the first step towards establishing diplomatic relations, was to repeal that legislation.
Anyway, we're still in 1870.
We're still in 1870.
So I wonder, what did Pius IX's choice to be voluntary prisoner in the Vatican entail for the popes who came after him for 52 years after that? Leo XIII, Pius X, Benedict XV, and halfway through of Pius XI. So 52 years. What did this entail for popes and more broadly for the Catholic Church?
Well, in some ways, beginning with Pius IX, he became a martyr pope. He had been very popular with the people initially, but then they turned against him. One has to be careful of how public opinion sways back and forth. So by the time of the overthrow of temporal power, he was no longer popular. And nevertheless, he was seen as the martyr pope by Catholics around the world because he was now the prisoner of the Vatican. Now, from my viewpoint, working mainly in the United States-Vatican relations, or Holy See relations, by and large, except for the Italian community, it didn't mean that much, although there were protests against the loss of temporal power. And you have to keep in mind the Italian Americans who went to the United States at that time. There wasn't that sense of nationality. But also it meant that they didn't have the same loyalty to the Pope that, say, the Irish Americans would. Because to have a united Italy, you had to end temporal power. So therefore, it wasn't the source of nationhood as it was for the Irish and later the Poles. But nevertheless, there were protests against it, but the American Catholic leaders were somewhat hesitant to say too much. For instance, when the statue of Giordano Bruno was put up.
Which is now in Campo di Fiori in
Rome. And most people don't know why it was put there, but he was supposed to be the pioneer of religious liberty in the sense that they were using it in the Kingdom of Italy. And the United States hierarchy, the bishops, were asked to protest it. Well, it was already there. And Cardinal Gibbons, the only cardinal in the United States, the Archbishop of Baltimore, said, well, nobody took any notice of it when it was put up. So now to have a protest would make the wrong impression. Catholics were still struggling to prove they were truly American, and they weren't subject to a temporal power under the Pope. So that was always the dilemma for the popes, for the Catholic people, the dilemma of their attitude towards the popes, I should say.
But getting back to Rome and the Catholic Church more broadly.
Well, by and large, remember that 1870 meant the establishment of the Third Republic in France, the Second German Empire, after the French were defeated in the Battle of Sedan, all in 1870. As a matter of fact, it was not accidental. From 1850 on, the Pope was kept in Rome, really, by French troops. They had to withdraw the French troops to fight against the Prussians, and then that led to the entry of the Italian army troops into the city of Rome. As far as the Pope was concerned, therefore, there was a usurpation, if you will. So by and large, within the continent, it meant the same effect took place, that it meant that there's a whole different relationship now with the Pope, who was no longer a monarch in any sense. In the English-speaking countries, it was a bit different because they never had the same thing. In Great Britain, Catholics were a minority. In the United States, they were a minority. And nevertheless, it's under Leo XIII, that begins in 1878, that there's an increase in missionary endeavor. So even though the Pope is now sort of isolated in that little acreage over there that we're looking at, but our listeners can't hear it, that we're looking at it, they can't see we're looking at.
103 acres,
I think, yeah. Translated into hectares or square meters, whatever you want to do. Just as an aside, during the Second World War, there was this rumor that the Vatican would be satisfied to have an airport there. Well, somebody pointed out there wasn't room for an airfield, but nevertheless.
The space people, just for a heliport. Yeah.
But for the most part, it meant the papacy was taking a whole different role, and one of the things that would emerge gradually was it was strictly a spiritual role. When there was temporal power, it meant that the Pope had to deal with other countries as another temporal leader did. So it took a while to realize that ultimately this was going to be a blessing in disguise. In fact, in the 1890s, there was a group headquartered pretty much around Cremona and Milan that was what up in northern Italy. And they were working for ending the Roman question by adapting the American approach to the separation of church and state. It worked to give freedom to the church in the United States. Maybe they could do the same thing here. That did not float well with Vatican officials, or the Holy See is the better term to use at this point, because if you speak of the Vatican, it's just the one palace, and Vatican City State did not come into being until 1929.
One question that people always ask themselves is, 1870, the Pope retired to the Vatican. What was there? Because the Popes lived in the Lateran Palace, and then they lived in the Quirinal.
Yeah,
then,
well, it
so
was.
Why did he go to the Vatican?
It was originally the Summer Palace because it was on the other side of the Tiber River. It was a little bit cooler.
Well, it wasn't built up in those days. It was.
It wasn't. No,
it was
that's
woodland.
True. Yeah, in fact, it wasn't until Mussolini that a lot of this area was built up. So the 1920s and 30s. But that was the main reason for choosing it, is that he could defend it for one thing. And the lines of Vatican City State were where the papal army stopped fighting, basically. There was a famous Italian general, Nino Bixio. There's a Nino Bixio street or something almost every Italian town. And he said if he had the privilege of entering the city, he'd burn the Vatican down too. Now, his brother, by the way, was a Jesuit. Some Italian writers claim that it was the brother who was the real rogue and had the influence on Nino. But Giuseppe Bixio, Joseph Bixio, worked in the United States for a good part of his time, and he was quite colorful. But anyway, just where Nino Bixio's troops stopped, really, is where under General Codorna, is where Vatican City came into being.
1870, there was a papal court in place. They reacted to the fact that the Pope was relegated to the Vatican of his own will.
Well, much of the nobility went with him, but there were two nobilities then, because you had the black nobility, which was the papal nobility, and you had the white nobility, which was the royal nobility, which, of course, one...
Because white was the color of the Savoy family. And,
yeah. And everyone would think, don't you have it wrong? Nope, it was the
and
white
the black
nobility.
Black aristocracy used to dress with black mantillas when they went to
That's
the
right.
audience to the Pope.
Which is still the case. Hmm. When a woman visits the Pope, she has to wear this black dress and black mantilla.
Well, theoretically. It doesn't happen a lot these days except on official occasions. What still takes place, though, is the privilege held by Catholic monarchs, obviously women or consorts of Catholic monarchs, to wear white. The Pope, when he was a prisoner in the Vatican, he still continued, despite losing temporal power, acting and speaking for the whole church. You see, no?
Oh, yes. And also he maintained his own diplomatic corps, which was recognized by the Lateran treaties, that he could maintain his own diplomatic corps. And freedom of communication, certainly with the cardinals, for instance, in the conclave of 1915, the Italian government provided a special train to meet the cardinals coming in from abroad, and special cars and everything. So that was recognized, even though they were still technically at war with one another, for lack of better terms. And I know 1915, 1922, they did that. And then after that, then it was sort of a recognition. So it was a strange relationship, because most listeners probably are not aware that there are now over 100 nations that have diplomatic relations with the Holy See. None of their embassies are inside the city, of the Vatican City. There's not enough room there. And therefore, they're spread throughout the city of Rome, which is the capital of the Italian Republic. So they're in a foreign country.
And many thanks there to Veronica Scarsbrick for that interview with American church historian Father Gerald Fogarty, who teaches at the University of Virginia. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.